Very happy.
It's Sunday, the last day. It's like, just get ready, go to school. So, okay, so we will start. I'm going to try not to jump around too much, but we're going to jump around a little. But we're just going to start. Look at source number one. This is the very end of Parsha's bow. So let's get our bearings for a second here, right? So in Parsha's Shmos, Moshe and Aaron, Moshe is chosen and Aaron's going to be with him. And they try their first time to go to Paro. Paro says, nothing happening. You're going to have to get the straw yourself. This is not going to go. I'm not listening to you. We get into, and Moshe comes back to Hashem all upset. What's going on here? How'd you do it? Fine. And Hashem says, don't worry, it's going to be fine. Veira starts, and we get the first seven Makos. And Veira, Makos go well, Paro's feeling bad, Egyptians are like, get them out of here already, but that's as far as we get. Parsha's bow is the last three. Arba Choshech and Makos Bechoros. And the beginning of the Parsha, you know, again, is Moshe goes back to Paro. We want to leave. Says, fine, you can go, but only the men can go for 3 days. Moshe's not going to do that. We have to go together as families. That's not going to work. So Paro says, fine, forget it, not leaving. Arbe, Choshech, which are very bad. And then, now Paro is like really on the ropes. He basically says to Moshe and Aaron, like, I don't want to see you anymore. And after Choshech, he basically says, like, I don't want to see it. Don't come back. Don't see me. You see me again, I'm going to kill you, he basically says. We're going to talk about why he says that in a second. And fine. So then Moshe goes into this whole long, right, he teaches about Rosh Chodesh, right, the first mitzvah that's given to Jewish people, and then he tells them about that you have to go take the sheep, and you're going to tie it to your doorpost 5 days before, and then see Machos Bechoros, etc. And that whole story happens here. Fine. But the, as we get to the end of Parsha's bow, all of a sudden, we start being told about, like, the future. What's going to happen when you're living in Eretz Yisrael? And one of the things that's focused on a bunch, if you look at source number one, is the conversations that will take place with your children and grandchildren. Right? So the Torah says, V'gad l'binicha b'yomahu le'mor. Again, once b'yomahu, then, in the far distant future, when I bring you to Eretz Yisrael, and you're living in Israel, et cetera, and you have a base at Mikdash, and what's going to happen? At that time, you're going to tell your children, you're going to tell the story that happened now. You're going to tell that story to your children then, much later. The sign on your hand and on your arm and on your head, this the tefillin. Because Hashem took us out with a strong arm. Etc. Fine. And then the Torah continues. And later on, when your child is going to ask you, what is this all about? You're going to tell him. You're going to tell the story to the child. Basically the same thing over and over again. Fine. But it's kind of a funny, Rabbi Sachs actually raises this question. He says that, you know, when people are on the precipice of freedom, so what do they usually talk about? Like, what do they get together to do? They don't know what to do when they get free. Yeah.
The day after.
The day after. Like, what are you going to need to be free? Mm-hmm. Right? There's certain things you're going to have to do. If you're living in, like, revolutionary America in 1776, so, like, all the guys with the wigs get together in a room and they figure out what's the Constitution going to be, even in Israel, right? 1948, like, you're getting ready to declare independence. You have to figure out what the law is going to be. What are we going to do? So we do get some of the laws. That's true. Mm-hmm. Right? But you don't have like this mass gathering of like the leadership to figure out what's going to happen. That's not what they do, right? Instead, what is the conversation about? What's going to happen? What's going to happen in 100 years from now? Right? It's kind of a funny thing to talk about at this moment. You really would think you should be talking about what's going to happen right now.
Who were the leaders? I mean, besides Moshe and Aaron.
Moshe and Aaron. There were these like Zakanim, who come up here or there. There end up being eventually there's Nisim, heads of each tribe. But you're right, there isn't, it's a pretty top-heavy leadership at this time also. The most top-heavy that it's being led by God, right? So that makes it hard for anyone else to really be a leader. No, it's true. And it's a real thing, right?
Yeah.
When leadership is I'm not saying this is too top heavy. This is the way it should be. But when leadership is too top heavy, it's actually unhealthy, right? That's what the Gemara talks about, the Mishnayos even, that when the Sanhedrin would speak, when the Sanhedrin would meet, so always you'd have the lowest, least regarded Dayanim, judges, would speak first. Why? Because once the top guy speaks, no one else is going to talk. Right, so you have to be careful how you structure leadership for that reason also. Mm-hmm. So the leadership is very top heavy. It's Moshe and Aaron based. That's it.
But didn't Hashem choose the 70 to
Cain? Yeah, yeah. That happens later. Hashem chooses 70 people later. That's true. Yes. But at this stage, there are some Zakenim, there are some elders, there are some Nisiyah maybe eventually. But there's not a lot of leadership. You're right. But maybe that's part of the point here. Like there isn't that leadership meeting, right? God is the leader. God is God, and Moshe and Aaron are the leaders. And basically, people are told what to do. Separate from our conversation, we're going to have, and maybe you can argue that's part of this. What do they do also the night they're about to leave? They don't meet as a community; they meet as
families.
Right? There's a big emphasis on the bias. The word bias comes up a gazillion times in the story of Yitzchak and Mitzrayim, and specifically on Seder night, like the first Seder night, that everything happened with the family first. It's not really what which we can talk about as that moves along, but that's also part of this, right? Conversations with children, that's the conversation, rather than conversations with leadership, politicians, structure. That's not what we're doing, right? It's very interesting. So we're going to have to figure out why that is. In order to talk about why that is, I want to turn your attention to a different part of Parshas Bo, which is earlier. And that is the story of Makas Bechoros, which Makas Choshech, which we have touched upon in the past here or there. But I want to touch upon a couple of things that happened in this story with Choshech. Choshech, to me, I find one of the most, it's a very rich Makkah. There's a lot of conversation about Choshech and what happened and how that plays out later. So, and we're going to see some of that right now.
Okay, scary.
Scary. Very scary. Very scary.
But why didn't Paro kill them before? Like, why did he kill them? Obviously, to him, they're doing some black magic and whatever.
Moshe and Aaron?
Yeah, I'm saying if they were coming...
Why didn't he kill Moshe and Aaron?
Yeah, if they were coming and putting these curses and plagues on Egypt, why did he just continue to let them put curses and plagues on Egypt? Like, why would... If it was any other person, why wouldn't they just...
Why didn't he kill them?
That's
a great question.
In the gods. He truly believes in the gods.
No, why didn't Paro...
Because it wasn't them. It was God. And he was afraid of their God.
Yeah.
He must.
If he was really afraid of their god, then he would have let them go.
Let's not be too logical about it, right, Jenny? Because you're right. If you really believe in it, then just let him go.
Right.
But it's a great point. I've actually never heard anybody ask that question.
More powerful than their god. I'm saying that he would just put an. I don't know. To me, it's like maybe put an end to it.
He thought God would then strike him if he struck them. God would strike him.
But God killed his firstborn. I mean, like, he brought Choshech. Like,
that's later, but yeah.
Right. I know what I'm saying. At what point does Paro not
Why
say,
doesn't
well,
Paro
done.
Kill
like,
Moshe?
Okay.
I don't know.
I don't know. It just seems like to me...
It's a great question. I don't have an answer for you yet. That's a really good question. Why doesn't he kill him?
It's part of the hardening
process. I do think that part of it, presumably, if I had to give an answer off the top of my head, would be something like what Rona was saying, that like, he had some sense that this is not just. Look, the fact that Hashem had to harden his heart right. means that what?
He did want to let them go.
He did want to let them go, and he did believe. Mm-hmm. Right? He did understand what was going on here. But even as much as we understand things, right, it's hard for us to give in. Right? We have a hard time letting go, especially for him. He's letting go of everything. Right? His whole economic structure is going to be destroyed. By them leaving, it'll be a total destruction of his economy. So as much as maybe he got it enough to know that killing Moshe and Aaron would be a bad idea, right? They would make their God very angry at him, but he still was not yet ready to let them go. Even though the truth is, naturally he was ready to let them go, but Hashem wouldn't let him. So it's sort of like you're right, and presumably that might be the answer. That he just couldn't do it. But let's shift now for a second to Choshech, and I want you to see a couple of very interesting things that go on. Take a look at source number two. Vayomer Hashem Moshe, O nega echad avi al paro va'mitzrayim, v'acharichen yishalech eschem. Sorry, this isn't actually Choshech.
Okay? No, but I'll explain it in a second. Okay? Because we're going to see things about Choshech because of this pasuk. This is right after Choshech. Mm-hmm. Right? Because how do I know it's not Choshech? Because he said, I'm only bringing one more.
Right.
So if it was before Choshech, he's bringing two more. So it's after Choshech. But he says, what does he say to Moshe to do? Daber na ba'ozne'am, right? Speak to the... And I'm going to send you out. You're going to be, kicked out of here. The bear na bazneam, speak please into the ears of the people. And he asked them, please do me a favor, ask Am Yisrael to go around and ask for gold and silver, etc., from their neighbors. Okay. And Hashem placed the chen.
Favor,
grace.
Mm-hmm.
The people liked the Jewish people, right? And even Moshe became like a very chashuv of a person. In the eyes of Paro, in the eyes of the Egyptian people. And I want to ask you two questions about this thing. Number one, daberna, right? Daberna, ask please, Hashem says. Pretty please. Hashem doesn't say, pretty please ask them to put on tefillin. It doesn't say, pretty please ask them not to eat chametz on Pesach. Pretty please take a sheep and shecht it. Daber na, please. Tell them, God commands. Tziva, right? Hashem commands us to do things and we do them because he's God. And here God says, Moshe, do me a favor. What in the world? It's so weird.
Moshe has a history of pushing back when he wants to.
Okay, but I'm just saying, Hashem typically tells Moshe to do stuff. Right. He doesn't say, daber na, please do me a favor, right? That's A.
Is this the only part? We've either discussed this before or there's another time when it says daber na.
This, we have discussed this before a little bit,
okay.
A few years ago. Yes, okay. A piece of this. Yes, okay. Yes, yes. It is familiar. Okay. And number two.
I don't remember the answer.
And number two, good. And number two, we're going to give different answers. But number two, what happens all of a sudden? This is the first time we ever hear this. Moshe Rabbeinu. The Egyptians love the Jewish people. And they love Moshe Rabbeinu.
What?
Sorry? They love Moshe and the Jewish people? When did that happen? When did this all change? Okay? All of this conversation takes place immediately after the Makkah of Choshech. Okay? And you're like, where am I taking you? I'm thinking something. Look at Rashi. Daber na. Why ask me, please? Eg na el lashon bakasha. Bevakasha mimcha. I'm asking you. His hiram al kach. So this is the medrash that's quoted often on this about this for this question is that Hashem was nervous, whatever that means, that he promised Avram, your children are going to go into the foreign land, they're gonna get punished and treated terribly, but then they're gonna go out with a lot of money. So Hashem is nervous that if the people don't go and ask for it, what's going to happen? They're going to leave without gold and silver, and Avram's going to be like, yo, God, you promised me, I know you said they're going to be in servitude, but you said they come out with money. Okay, that's one answer. Okay, good. I feel the same way. Right? We all feel that way. Fine, good. There are other answers to this question, but I want to show you what Rav Hirsch says. Rav Hirsch says something astonishing, and the Netziv says something even more astonishing. And this is going to bring us to Rabbi Sachs' answer to our original question. Okay? The first writes the following. The statement made in the preceding verse that Paro would drive them out completely and permanently. Next. Taberna. Na always implies reluctance on the part of the person addressed. Right? So what does Avram say to Sarah? Imri na achosiat. Say please that you are my sister. Why? Because she didn't want to do that. Mm-hmm. It was hard for her. But he asks her please. So you ask please to someone who doesn't want to do something. The people had just proven their moral worth in the most brilliant manner. How's that? For 3 days, their oppressors, blinded and rooted to the spot by darkness, had been completely at their mercy. For 3 days, all the possessions of the Egyptians had lain unprotected in their homes. But no Jew took advantage of this opportunity for revenge. No Jew touched an Egyptian or even the least of his possessions. It was at this moment when sight was restored to the Egyptians that they found all their possessions intact where they had left them, that God caused the Egyptians to comprehend the moral greatness of this people. This realization at last overcame the antipathy the Egyptians had felt for the Hebrews, and more than all the miracles he had performed, the moral greatness of his people made the man Moshe much esteemed in the eyes of the Egyptians. I want you to think about that phrase for 1 second. Moshe had turned the Nile to blood. Moshe had brought, you know, hail with fire and ice. He had done everything you could possibly do. And there was no interest of the Egyptians in the Jews. Whoa, they're so amazing. Look at their God, so powerful. What was the thing that turned them on the Jews in a positive way?
They didn't steal from us.
They didn't steal from them. Our houses were left wide open. Imagine you go away on vacation and you come home and you realize that you left the doors wide open to your house. Right? And you come home and your house is fine. There's no one touched a thing. Right? So how do you feel about your neighbors? And how do you feel about the people who were living in your neighborhood? You're like, wow. I live in a pretty, like, respectable place. To be honest, if that would happen to me, I wouldn't be so super surprised. I think I live in a place of, like, pretty civilized people. So I wouldn't be so surprised if that happened around where I live. But I think I feel positively about the people that I live near, right? But if you're the Egyptians, and you're living with the Jews, and near the Jews, and this happens, and the Jewish people who you despise, and you think and imagine all kinds of horrible things about them, and you beat, and you subjugate, etc., and then they do nothing to you. Mm-hmm. I'm like, holy cow. And you know that if it was you, and they were, right, in that position, what would you have done? You would have taken their stuff, right? Their big screen TV and their diamond rings and their whatever, and you would have done that, and you didn't. You're like, holy cow. This is a unique type of people. I've never met anybody like this. So at that moment, there's a switch, right? And now there's a chen ha'am b'nei Mitzrayim. They feel different about the Jewish people. Perhaps Moshe and the people were reluctant. So now that happens. Good. So now, so how the Egyptians feel about the Jews? Great. And now Hashem says, now go take all their money.
But we'll ask them first.
Okay. Is there any?
How the Jewish people, hold on. How are they going to respond to that?
Are you out of your mind?
Look what we just did.
Right.
Look what we just accomplished.
Yeah. They're going to fight us for it. They're not going to want it.
It's an amazing idea. Right?
But it's also like, I think we see kind of consistently in the Torah until now that like our modern sense of like justice isn't like what the same as Hashem's sense of justice.
Okay.
And the things that are important to us aren't the same things that are important.
Sometimes.
It's not about like, I don't know, I was thinking, I forget when you just... Oh, like talk about like violence, like when someone's like we do need to like murder our enemies, and like there is that kind of call, like when you think, oh, we're fine now, we can just live in peace, and Hashem's like, no,
it's not about being. Go kill the bad guys.
I don't care what they think of you. It's not about what they think of you.
Right.
It's about like what I said is going to happen, and that
right
being able to happen.
So, but even then, says Rav Hirsch, in that moment, caused this like strain. I don't even call it.
Tension.
Thank you. For Am Yisrael. Thanks, guys. For Am Yisrael, right? So he writes, perhaps Moshe and the people were reluctant to compromise this moral victory by making such requests to the Egyptians as God now commanded them to make. However, it was God's will that his people should not leave empty-handed. For other reasons, we've talked about, I think this before, at different times, this different idea from Rabbi Sacks, about the importance of the people leaving with money so that they can get past their anger and their resentment. Right, there was a big value in the walking away with something so that they wouldn't forever resent the Egyptian people. Right, but fine. But whatever God's big idea was, the previous generations, having spent their lives in slavery, had not been able to acquire even the most modest possessions. It was God's will that the first foundation stone of His people's prosperity should be acquired and consecrated through the recognition of their moral greatness by those who hitherto had despised them. Hence, the use of na. Right? But the point is, why na? Is na because I know what you just accomplished. And I know it's going to be hard for you now to flip it and go ask. But I want you to do it anyways. Okay? Moreover, time was growing short. Only 12 hours were left until noon the next day. Therefore, Daber na bazne'am, persuade them, urge them to take this step. Fine. So that's one explanation for why Daber na bazne'am.
I'm only arguing with Rav Hirsch. I think it's a beautiful idea.
Yeah, but...
But if you would take that and put it in the context of, like, let's say the Holocaust, right?
Yes.
Do the Jewish people care what the Egyptians think about them? Who cares? Oh, you think we're wonderful? Oh, congratulations. Like, who cares what they think of us?
Yeah.
Why do I need the Egyptians' approbation of me? I know who I am. Like, I just feel like, it's all very nice, but, like, really, who cares?
That's true. And by the way, that's what God said. In the end, I don't care enough. Doesn't matter to me enough. I want you to get the money, right? But I think it's actually a fascinating psychological, emotional, like you see this, and this happens in movies all the time, but I mean this part in a good way, that like, in the, and it doesn't have to be movies, it's in life, right? When it isn't, and I talk to my kids about this all the time, and I don't know, maybe eventually they'll tell me that they heard it, but they're like, what matters in moments when people treat you a certain way, right? What matters much more in terms of your moving forward in your life is not, let's say, what happens to the bad guy, but it's about how I hold myself, right? So it's about how I move through moments of challenge and how I find strength to do X or Y or Z, moral, and find moral greatness for myself, even in the face of disgusting, horrible, terrible people, right? That sort of allows me to hold my head high and maybe even have that sense of self even after being treated so terribly.
No, right? I'm agreeing with that. I'm just saying, but you know for yourself how you are and how you act. And I'm saying, do you really care how your oppressor, your tormentor views you?
No, so my point is that you're right. Maybe it's not about how they view you, but if you feel so good about what you just did, mm-hmm. about the type of person that you are, then having to spin around and ask for them, you might feel that takes that away from you. What God is maybe saying is it doesn't. Right? And you don't have to feel that way. You can actually get what belongs to you and what you deserved, right? And it doesn't take away from the greatness that you've shown in that moment. But maybe you might be feeling that way. So daber na is, please do it anyways. I know that's hard for you because you might feel like you're letting go of the thing that you just accomplished, but you're not, right? But you're right. I think that's the tension.
Okay.
That's the point. Yeah, yeah. The Nitziv says something even more astonishing in source number 5. And then I'm going to tell you where Rabbi Sack says. So the Nitziv in source number 5 says, Ish me esrei'ehu, right? So they, in the moment, while they were actually in Choshech, so they weren't able to see each other in any way, right? But then when it's time to take the money, what did he say? They should take Ish me esrei'ehu, Isha me esrei'usa. Each person, Jew, should go take from Re'ehu, his friend. Well, his friend.
It's true.
The Egyptian friend, Isha me esrei'usa. Her Egyptian friend. Well, sorry, they're friends now. Okay, so take this. Look at this. He says, "Le'el gimel chavbeis k'siv v'shala yisha me'shchenta u'migeras beitza sha'az hayu hadvarim sheyetsu miyad." Right, but v'lo haya hitro'us liYisrael im anshei Mitzrayim rakim shchenos. They didn't have any like fighting with them. Aval kasher Allah ki lo nigalu ad shehishe yud beischodesh hayad. Sorry. I want you to skip down for a second. The part of the question he's asking is, you know, why they're friends? Like, what does that mean? So he says the following. V'lo'od. Three lines down, V'lo'od. El b'makas choshech shelo kamu ish mitachtav gimel yamim. 3 days of choshech, they could not move. Okay? V'heich hit anu kulam gimel yamim. How did they all fast 3 days, Egyptians?
Right.
How's that possible? They didn't die?
I was thinking of that.
Pass out? Like, didn't eat anything for 3 days? It's impossible. El Yisrael Shahaya Orba Moshwasam Hoshitu Lahem Mazon. They gave them, the Jews gave them food. They fed them. V'kol ha'echrechi. V'lo samchu le'edam v'lo nikmu bahem. They didn't have simcha at what happened to them, and they didn't take revenge on them. U'bazeh hisigu Yisrael chein gadol b'einehim. And that's how the Egyptians came to love them so much. And that's how they're called Ish Me Esrei'ehu, Isha Me Esrei'usa, because they took care of them. Wild.
That's like
bizarre.
Stockholm Syndrome.
I was just going to say that. I was just thinking it's like Stockholm Syndrome.
Yeah, it's like weird.
It's like
crazy.
You feel bad
for the abuser.
That you're right. And
but also, the argument,
you're necessarily the abusers.
Right. So the argument, argument here, I think, would be that this is like you kept them from dying. Like you're keeping them alive. You're not like, you know,
I need to know
two
more.
Nice things, then.
Like, where the Egyptians, like, laying down, moaning, groaning. I'm going to die. I'm going to die. And the Jews are like, oh, I can't take it anymore here. Like, have
no, they said, I'm going to have rachmanas. I'm not going to make you, I'm not going to let you die because you're not, like, you didn't kill me. So I'm not going to, like, I'll give you something to drink. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, that's not my main point, though. So I don't want to.
I know.
It bothers you. Good, good. It's fine. Good. But let's move to the last one. To the last one. And I'm going to leave you just on this one because you have to go. But Rabbi Sacks, and I couldn't find it inside, so I'm sorry. I looked all over the place for this, and I couldn't find it. But I know I didn't make it up. There's no way I made it up. There's no way. I have it in my notes. There's no way I made it up. And he says things like this, but not to this. He says something like this in other places, but it's further developed by this. But I thought maybe it's in the Haggadah, maybe it's why I couldn't find it, and I looked there, I couldn't find it there either. It's somewhere. He says it's somewhere, because I didn't make it up. He says the following. He says that we think that Parshas Bo is teaching us, like, this is like the end, right? But there's something like, there's like an underlying narrative here that's going on all along, and sort of like opposite directions. The way the Jews are heading in one direction and Paro and the Egyptians are heading in a different direction. And that comes to a head sort of in Machas Choshech. And he explains like this. If you notice, last week already, right, Paro starts to give in. And what does he say? Fine. You want to go serve God? Serve God. So take a look at source number 6. What does he say? Vayikra Paro Moshe al Aron vayomru vayomer lechu zivchu leloheichem ba'aretz. Go serve your God here. I have to go off 3-day journey. Do it here. Right? Have a house minion. Do it right here. Why do you have to go far away? Do it right here. Sorry. You have to go far away. Vayomer Moshe. Lo nachon lasa. That didn't make any sense. Vayomer Moshe. Lo nachon lasa oskein. I can't do that. Ki toavas mitzrayim nizbach l'ashem elokeinu. He nizbach es toavas mitzrayim le'nehem v'lo yuskalunu. What? God, Paro, do you know we're going to shecht? We're going to shecht, you know, sheep. Yeah. And you guys are going to go crazy. You're going to kill us. The Egyptians are going to kill us. We're shechting their gods. We're going to ship we're going to shecht a cow. These are all your gods. We can't do that here. They're going to kill us if we do that. Really? The Jews are so worried about shechting the Egyptian god with the Egyptians noticing? Well, something changes, right? Because not so far later, this week's Parsha, Moshe commands them, Mishchu kulechem tzon. Go. Why is it called Shabbos HaGadol? Shabbos HaGadol is a Shabbos HaGadol not because it's a big speech. It's called Shabbos HaGadol because it was the day, it was on Shabbos, that the Jews each went, and they went over to an Egyptian and said, hey, can I have your sheep? Can I have your sheep, please? And he says, why? He says, because I'm going to kill it as a korban.
But they had their own flocks. Yeah,
at this point, they didn't have their own flocks.
Oh, no.
They didn't have anything. So they go and they purchase or they get sheep, or they take their own sheep, but they walk it through the town, and the Egyptians, what are you doing? That goes, oh, I'm tying it to my bedpost. Why? Because in 5 days, I'm going to kill it and eat it. And what did the Egyptians do?
Sure.
Nothing. Yeah. They did nothing. Shabbos HaGadol is a big nace that the Egyptians did nothing to them. By the way, how are you supposed to cook a Korban Pesach?
Roast it.
Where do you roast it? Where do you roast your... Outside. Barbecue.
And boy, the smell.
Barbecue.
Yeah.
Barbecue, right? The smell of roasting meat was all over Egypt. Right? But what... How did that happen? I thought we're afraid. If we do that, we're going to get killed. Right? So Rabbi Sacks says, yeah, because there's a different mindset for the Jewish people. Initially, they're afraid. They're withering. They're nervous. Mm-hmm. Right? They have no sense of who they are and who they're going to be. But once you start to create for a person a sense of a future and a sense of hope, so what happens? All of a sudden, they become stronger and bolder and braver and more courageous. And they can do things that otherwise they'd be afraid to do.
And
stand up for themselves.
After they asked for the silver and gold, they also asked for...
So Rabbi Sacks argues that's part of what happens in Choshech, as they stand up, right? But what also happens is that this also is going to explain... that's one direction, okay? But what happens after Choshech, Taparo? This is a different point. Look at source number 8. What does Paro say to them? Vayomer lo Paro, leich me'alai. Till now, all the conversation is actually fascinating. We learn from Moshe, Chazal say, that when you talk to a king, you talk with respect, even an evil king. Moshe always speaks to Paro like in third person. He speaks to him extraordinarily respectfully. Mm-hmm. He shows a lot of respect to Paro. He doesn't talk to him nastily. He doesn't say mean things to him. He just says, this is how it's going to be. but he talks always with respect. And Paro actually, for the most part, responds to Moshe rather calmly until after Choshech. Vayomer Paro, Lech me'alai, get out of here. He shamalacha al tosef ra'os panai ki biyom ra'oscha panai tamus. The next time I see your face, you're going to die. Right? Till now, he didn't threaten to murder Moshe, like Jenny pointed out. But now he's going to kill him. What happened? So Rissax argues that Paro slowly starts to see that he has no future. And he falls into despair. Right? And you have, on the one hand, the Jews are headed in this direction. They're headed up. And they feel hopeful and prideful and courageous. And they have something to look forward to. And Paro sees his future becoming destroyed. Right? And it's after Choshech, where it's like the most, like, almost like embarrassing and paralyzing, literally, moment for them, right? The most terrifying. He literally is paralyzed and can't move for 6 days that he realizes he's stuck, right? But there's another reason why everybody's access. Because what is Moshe asking for all this time? We want to go for how many days?
3 days.
How many days was Choshech?
3.
It's actually 6. There's 3 days they can't move and 3 days when they just can't see. If you're the Jewish people, you wanted to go away for 3 days. When would you have gone?
Then.
Go during Choshech. If the 3-day journey is all you're asking for, go then. Mm-hmm. They didn't go. And Paro knows that. What does that mean? They're not going for 3 days. Mm-hmm. They're really going to leave forever. Mm-hmm. And it's at that moment that Paro sees, all comes crashing down. And he realizes he's done. And that's why he starts to become impetuous and nasty, and he just starts to lose it. Because as the Jewish people, you put the two words together, as the Chein Ha'am and the Chein Moshe, right? Paro starts to hear that Moshe is the, on the cover of Time Magazine, Man of the Year, and the Jewish people are everyone's favorite. So what does Paro know about himself? I'm the opposite. I'm the opposite, right? And he starts to lose it, right?
Didn't he even pursue them as they're escaping, so?
Not yet. Not until later. But yes.
Yeah, but he does.
He doesn't even pursue them. Because he's given up. He's lost. Right? And at that point, he's done. Right? And Rabbi Sachs argues, that is why, as we're getting ready to leave Mitzrayim, at this moment, right, just after Choshech, and before Makkos Bechoros, what's the conversation about? Let's have a vision for the long game. What's going to be for you guys for centuries? What's going to be for you guys for decades going on? Right? Not what's going to happen tomorrow. Tomorrow we'll figure out. I want you to be thinking about a vision of what you can be. I want you to have hope for the future, what you can be. When you have that, then you can do anything. Right? Now you can rise up from this place and be something different. As opposed to Paro, who has no sense of his future anymore. His future is as fallen apart. And that's why he just becomes inactive totally, and he becomes paralyzed literally and does nothing and just chases them out and just says, just get away from me. Because even though them leaving is the worst thing in the world for him at that point, because his whole future is destroyed, but he's given up on his future. And
how many different Paros were there over the 210 years?
I don't know. That's a good question. Probably a few. But the point that Rabbi Sachs makes is that that's why, right? Choshech is like this turning point, right? In so many different ways. But Rabbi Sachs's point is that the Choshech is the turning point because it's that moment when the Jews start to hope for the future and Paro loses hope. Because if you have hope, you can do anything. That was famously what Viktor Frankl said, right? A person who has a why can make it through any.
But then also,
if a person has something to live for.
Many of the Jews died in Choshech. How come? What if they would have done Shuva? How could they have? Why should they?
Why did they die?
Didn't they die? Yeah, they weren't.
Yes, they died in Choshech. Yes, which is actually interesting. I never put these two together, but it is true that according to the Medrash, many of the 4/5 of the Jewish people died in Choshech. These were people who what? Who didn't want to leave.
Who didn't want to leave,
And maybe this goes together.
What if they would have done tshuva,
I mean, a person has a chance to do tshuva until it's too late.
Sometimes
it's too late. You wait till you die. I mean, every person only has a certain amount of time to do tshuva, right? But I never thought about this point, that maybe this idea, at least in the Medrash, of 80% of the Jewish people who didn't want to leave, dying. Why? Because the people who are going to be the future of Am Yisrael, they're the people who have a belief and a hope for something different in their life. The same thing happens in the desert, as we talk about all the time. Mm-hmm. Right? The first generation in the desert never went into Eretz Yisrael because they didn't have that belief in themselves, that they could do something greater. They couldn't get out of that, right? They couldn't get out of that slave mentality. But at least at the beginning, Hashem says, I'm not just gonna do it for you the whole way through. You need to have some belief in yourselves.
And if you have that, you go. Who jumped into the river first?
Yes, right. Which is part of that also. But it has to come. Part of it has to come from us. And we have to find that ability to see our future. And if we can see that, and if we can have hope, and we can talk about what's going to be in the future, and that's why the conversations here are about that, then we can do just about anything else. And that's why we continue to do that to this very day. We're a people who has a hope and a dream for the future of our people, and that's why we can manage the horrifying things we've managed over the past 15, 16 months, because we know that we have a future. We have a promise that we have a future. And having that promise and knowing that, that having that confidence in who we are, it's everything. It's everything, because otherwise you wither away and you give up. And that vision for the future, that hope, is what gives you strength to do just about anything. Okay?
Thank you.